Professor Martin E. Marty. Dr. Marty is professor of the history of modern Christianity at the University of Chicago and associate editor of the Christian Century. He received his Ph.D. at Chicago in American religious and intellectual history in 1956 and teaches there now in the Divinity School, the History Department, and the Committee on the History of Culture. He is the author of numerous books. Some jokester actually listed them here and expected me to read them all. The most recent of which are The Hinge of Revolution, Early 1977, and A Nation of Behaviors. He co-edits Church History and edits the newsletter Context, and contributes to major journals and encyclopedias. The past president of the American Society of Church History in 1971, winner of the National Book Award for his book Righteous Empire in 1972, he holds 9 honorary degrees, is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a bunch of other things. Dr. Marty serves on the board of the National Humanities Center, the Illinois Humanities Council, and McNeil Memorial Hospital. He is a member of the Authors Guild, the National Book Critics Circle, and other associations of historians. Now for the important news. He was born February 5th, 1928, at West Point, Nebraska. In 1952, he married Elsa Schumacher. The Martys are parents of 5 sons, one of them a foster son. He was ordained to the Lutheran ministry in 1952. He served in pastoral vocations for 11 years before joining the university faculty in 1963. His latest honor is that he was selected the Fairfax M. Cohen Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. And in addition to all of this, he's a warm, fun-loving human being. Dr. Marty.
Thank you. You said the most important news was that I was born. I was born again, too, on February 26, 1928. So took me 3 weeks to catch on. I have kind of an image that I'm in a diehard group here because 3 times he's announced the lights are on and nobody gets up to turn them off, so they're sure that there'll be that Sears diehard battery working away day in and day out. Even a first aid call for somebody who did go out and slipped along the way, probably. Good to be back. I was here once when it was still only the Luther convocation, and glad to be here with the joint gathering now. I don't know what year it was, but I know I was in the pastorate at the time, and until I came, I didn't know there were that many ministers in the world, as I saw at the winter convocation, and I see it's even grown more since. My other great memory of the time, apart from the fact that that's when I first met the late Dr. Kent Knudsen and treasure the friendship that grew out of that occasion, was the fact that it took me about 3 weeks to work off the caffeine. I've since sworn off coffee, so I don't expect quite such a heavy physical toll as it was last time I visited the Twin Cities. Good to be back, and this morning in the lecture I'm going to talk about the people we serve, the cultural context of our ministry today and in the near future. In the afternoon, in a smaller workshop, I'm going to talk a little bit about something of minister and ministry for such a time. So this morning, congregation in culture. Within the past year, I have addressed some of you and let out my own sociological model for how I view society and the church, and I just have to repeat that so we're all on the same ground here. I always see society pretty much the way Al Capp of the late Lil Abner saw the shmoo. If you remember the shape of the shmoo, the small head and the large body. The body is the ballast, the great weight, the writing itself. If your children have a roly-poly, you know very much what that is like. And the head is the part that is obviously visible and noticed. It can smile, it can grimace, it can do what it wants, it can turn very fast. And most of the time, those of us who write the history of Christianity, or even more, those of us who report on its current and stage and its recent past, tend to look at the head of the shmoo. The mass media of communication often have a very hard time knowing what the great mass of people are doing, but you notice if someone rises above them, someone becomes an influential, joins the jet set, becomes a part of an elite. Thus, the New York media, for example, didn't know there were 13 million Southern Baptists in the country, or certainly knew nothing about them until one of them became president, and then suddenly they discover the Southern Baptist Convention. If you've known American religion, if you've known the American South, if you know American Protestantism, you know that you can't get very far without reckoning with the huge reality of the 13 million people who are in some ways represented typically, in some ways atypically, by the national leadership, the most prominent ministers and the president and so on. And so it is that I try to keep both angles of vision alive when I do the kind of reporting I'm doing today. At the end of each year, those of us in the religion news writing business or the encyclopedia yearbook business have to do an instant reckoning as to what happened in that year. And the returns are all in this week, and the debate is, was the biggest religious news this year the Episcopal schism, or was it the religious implications of the Sadat-Begin discussions, the Arab-Israeli overcoming of some of the great gaps between them also as religious groups? That's head of the shmoo language, and it certainly will affect us all, not necessarily the Episcopal schism, but the Sadat-Begin thing might have a great deal to do with world peace. But there's another sense in which I have a hunch that if you took out the bulletin covers of the year a few years from now, you wouldn't find that that was really what our congregations were living by directly. This year, what's ahead? Maybe more Anwar, Sadat, and Begin, maybe more denominational schisms, maybe more debates of that type. But in most of your parishes, debates will more likely center on whether their favorite hymn was left out of LBW or whether so-and-so came through with enough ticket sales for a church supper or whatever. And I try to keep both of these in mind in my analysis, and I'll hope it'll show so that as we get chance for a discussion anytime later today, we'll have a base, and you might have a little do-it-yourself kit for seeing the life of the people in the larger culture. Because I'm not as close up to them as you are. No two congregations are alike. No two people in a congregation are alike. And therefore, I can't say what all those people are like. But I'll try to describe something of the envelope, the psychic, spiritual surrounding in which we're living these days. My first assertion about the people in our congregations may sound like a very strange one to say, but from the head of the shmoo crowd, it's an interesting one to say. And that is, we are a religious people in a religious culture, and will remain a religious people in any foreseeable future. Now, why is that a strange thing to say? Naturally, congregations are religious. But I don't think the congregations perceived until fairly recently how religious the culture around them is. Certainly the people who gave signals about the future of the culture didn't picture it. And I would have to say I was among those who in the late or mid-1960s shared something of the outlook of Friedrich Gogarten, or the later writings of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, or the early writings of Harvey Cox, or the middle ill writings of Bishop Robinson, all of whom projected a future in which people around the Christian churches would be less religious, and Christians themselves might be religionless. Less showed up both in the cultural analysis and in the churchly analysis. By which they meant to say, with some good reason, that the indicators in the world from roughly World War II till about 1965 suggested that humans were ever more conscious of being in control. Technopolis was a key word. Technopolis, the combining of techne, what man makes, with polis, the human city, where men and women determine their own fate. The apotheosis, the divinization of the human in control, the human as computer with legs, as Fortune magazine called it. The human who could dominate, who could take nature and transform it and use it to his or her purposes. This was the emerging model, and the corollary prediction, therefore, was the things that had been with humans from primitive times, historic religious times, would increasingly disappear. Most of these things started with M, which made me kind of nervous. Meditation, no more meditation, no more metaphysics, no more mysticism, no more mystery, no more magic, no more miracle. I think you know very well what the kind of prophecies were. It didn't turn out that way, and it gives no sign of turning out that way. We simply weren't looking at the body of the shmoo at the time, because while those predictions were going on, the world was lining itself up in religious terms. Since World War II, virtually every armed conflict has been over tribal, ethnic, religious lines. Not specifically religious, not always to fight out the dogmas of competing religions, but religion was at least the most important epiphenomenon, the most attached kind of thing, that which could most uglify a war or beautify its peace. Muslim, Hindu, in the subcontinent of India, Israel, Jew, Arab, Muslim in the Middle East, Protestant and Catholic in Northern Ireland, tribalism in most of the African nations, many religions in Lebanon, and the like. No one was noticing this. Not many noticed the degree to which religious symbolization was attached to the movements that looked so secular in the 60s. The rise of feminism led to a re-examination of the ways in which masculine imagery was attached to deity, locked in scripture, recalled to the memory and the practices of the church. Albert Clagy, a Detroit cleric in 1968, talked about the beautiful word, the religiosification of the black movement, as if it had ever been anything but religious. Almost every leader was a reverend, and almost all the symbols from the days of Denmark V.C. and Nat Turner and Gabriel Prosser and Daniel Walker, the rebels of the 1830s in the black slave rebellions, down through the leadership in Reconstruction, down to the Reverend Martin Luther King and the Reverend Andrew Young and the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and all the rest, used the language of righteousness of Amos and Isaiah and John the Baptist and Jesus, and used the language of promised land and hope of Moses and the letter to the Hebrews. The American Indian recovery has been a recovery of the classic Indian concepts of the sacralization of place and tribe and nature. And all that was going on, and we thought that the magic and mystery were disappearing. And they're back, very visibly back, exposed to view. And I think this will have something to say with the way our people will look at their life. They will feel a little less beleaguered They will feel at home. They will feel that it is not eccentric, idiosyncratic, weird to speak up, to witness, to bear the name of Christ, because celebrities in the society are doing so. The national magazines may cover stories of it. The public media allow more and more room for it. The people whom some of their children admire are not ashamed of it. And the cotton bowl begins with a prayer. I think that's important for us to notice because it certainly represents both opportunity and threat to the Christian faith. What's interesting to me is that during all the years when religion seemed to be dying in the world, we were tooling ourselves up to be nervous about the theological meaning of religion. If you can think your way back to neo-orthodoxy, Karl Barth has a 50,000-word footnote called Religion aus Unglaube, religion as unbelief. That's literally true, by the way. They take some of his footnotes and make whole books out of them. The book Christ and Adam is literally a footnote from his dogmatics. Costs $5.95 now. Should have bought it in German when nobody noticed the fine print. Religion aus Unglaube, religion as unbelief. And maybe you remember Dietrich Bonhoeffer's sentence quotation from Luther, that God may very well prefer the angry shout of the struggling atheist to the pious prattle of the overbelievers. The concern from the viewpoint of the Christian gospel that when everybody's doing it, maybe nobody's doing it, that you can't fill a full vessel, you can't add to it, it'll just spill over, that you can't attract people to a gospel when they're already filled in their ears, that if somebody's busy with their religion, which in my image is sawing the bars off the imprisoning walls of the spiritual jail around them, they don't notice that in Christ the key has already been opened and the door is open, and that's grace. I'm on a papal commission. Guess what name? Non credente, non-believers. Pope John used to always say, we have these separated brothers, Protestants and Orthodox, then we have the spiritual cousins, the Jews, and then we have the other people of the book, the Muslims, then we have the people of Eastern religion who don't know God clearly, but they strive for God. And then we have all these wonderful people of goodwill out there to whom we should relate, who know no God. And so his poor successor, Pope Paul, was pressed at the council to name a commission to study all those people out there who knew no God. And so it's called non credente, non-believers. We held a meeting once at the Vatican. Italian papers called it De Ateismo, a conference on atheism. There are Marxists, there are atheists, there are agnostics, and there are Protestant historians and sociologists on the commission. And we didn't find much non-credente, non-believing. We find other believing. Anthropologists and sociologists and historians, wherever they look, find people somehow being religious even when they no longer know they are religious. That's not so interesting. What's interesting to me is the attitude of many of the Catholic theologians as they listen in on the discussion. They often look as if their work is half done. Isn't it nice that the world is friendly? Isn't it nice that the world is religious? Well, it is in the sense that you can get the conversation going. Again, it is in the sense that people do take seriously some of the things that we in the church like to think of ourselves as nourishing and nurturing. But as far as proclamation of the gospel is concerned, we also know that problem. A dozen years ago, I used to get letters from parents. I have a daughter at the University of Chicago. She's too secular. Could you talk to her? Now I get letters. I have a son at the University of Chicago. He's too religious. Could you talk to him? by which they usually mean they become a member of some sort of religious cult group. We're out of touch. They won't come home. They're thinking of dropping studies. They want to go off with the Unification Church or Hare Krishna or one of the Jesus communes or something and simply break relations with the family. Quite a number of them are Jews and have the Christian Jews for Jesus groups working on them. And a complete sundering of the family tradition, complete break of any communication. Can you deprogram them a little bit? I can only say that it was a lot easier a dozen years ago to witness, to talk the meaning of Christ and get a hearing from that too secular kid than it is to talk to somebody who's in Hare Krishna, somebody who's already got a religion, an answer for everything, a completely worked out, warm and strong support group. So I think that's one of the things we really want to watch in the years ahead with the people we serve. That we understand the double-sidedness of the religiosity of our culture, that we welcome the striving of humans in the realm of the spirit, even as we recognize, if we're Lutheran, that that striving itself is often used as a claim upon God and a barrier to the hearing of the gospel. The church lives by the promise of God in the midst of any kind of culture, and I'm not describing this culture as one uncongenial to what we're about, but as somewhat different than a dozen years ago we expected it to be. The United States Supreme Court in 1951 used the phrase that I used to begin this morning, "We are a religious people." It was none other than Justice William O. Douglas, who is often criticized for being non-religious on the court, who coined the phrase, and in 1962 and 63, in the school prayer decisions, which many people thought was taking God out of the society, it was again quoted. They were not taking God out of society, they were trying to keep classrooms classrooms and let chapels be chapels. But in the midst of that, urging that religion be taught, talked about in our society, they simply made that statement, "We are religious people." And I'm arguing that's still true. I'm not an anthropologist. I'm not a philosopher of history. I cannot say, in other words, that to be religious is the human condition. Homo religiosus, this is called. I have a hunch it is. I have a hunch that to be in the world is to be condemned to make sense of the world and to do that in reference to the highest and deepest symbols and stories and to surround that with ceremony. But I must say I know people who give very little evidence of doing any of that. So I don't know whether it is the human condition to be religious, but I will say that in the world cultures, America has surprised people by remaining religious. That leads me now to my second set of propositions. We are in the late stage of a religious revival, and we should not gear our mission to its remaining in the stage in which it is. When you hear me talking about 1963, 4, 5, the years of secular city and honest to God and religionless Christianity, as if it were an epoch back with the early Middle Ages, and that we've changed that much since then, and that the people of that day were convinced that they changed that much from the world of 1939, we ought to be alert to the fact that change is the law of life, also the law of life in our culture, and that we should not picture that every detail of the culture around us is going to remain the same, and that therefore all we have to do is tag along and be relevant to it. So what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is to suggest the ways in which the people we serve in our congregations have, if they're in midlife at least, already moved through three stages of the current revival. I see American religion, as most historians do, as a succession of cultural revitalizations. The first great awakening of the 1730s and 40s that produced the new modern style of being church members, in which you had to get religion. It wasn't just inherited through the genes and passed on through the family tree. Second great awakening, 1801 FF, in which America was churched as people moved west and as the immigrants came and were more religious in America than they'd been in Europe. And maybe there'd been a third awakening around 1857, 58, down to the 1870s, in which the new evangelistic styles of Dwight Moody and others emerged in the cities. And now since World War II, at least since the early 1950s, there has been an almost constant discussion by people who watch the head of the Shmoo of religious revival. And if you move past the head to the body, there are many indicators that the public also has been involved. And these three stages are as follows, and we got them just backward. The first stage, I think, was the Eisenhower era revival. It's the one in which I did my own first examining and writing, which was fundamentally an institutional revival of religion. America had gone through a religious depression along with economic depression. They hadn't built churches since the 20s. They'd been torn apart by the polarities and tensions of the Depression. They had seen a loss of membership. Protestants had been torn apart by the fundamentalist modernist controversy and were demoralized. The continentally based groups like the Reformed and the Lutheran were having a hard time adjusting to the modern American scene. And in the late 30s, there were a lot of indicators that religion was on the European pattern of decline. And then after World War II, first few years, no one quite knew what was happening, and suddenly we were aware of the greatest Völkerwanderungen of American history, the move to the suburbs, when one-third, one-half, maybe two-thirds of the people were involved in a move. And when people migrate, they need symbols to make sense of that life, and they built churches. The GIs came back, shattered by their experiences around the world, and they wanted nothing more than to sink in roots, to have a rather quiet way of life, and to build a secure way for themselves and their children. And for them, this meant worship, belonging. The word belonging came to be a very big part of American religion. In 1955, Will Herberg wrote a classic study, Protestant Catholic Jew, in which he showed how the impulse to know who we are in a society where it was very hard to have an identity was important. There was only one American way of life, argued Herberg, but you grabbed that three different ways, Protestant, Catholic, Jew. It was an era of big families, and so we built Sunday school wings. It was a time when GIs back on campus needed to know each other and to make sense of their existence, and huge campus chapels, two large chapels, were built. But when we look back on that era, it's not often remembered as a time of ethical renewal, spiritual renewal. There was some theological renewal, again, quote, in the head of the Shmoo. It was a great era for Catholic theology. Jacques Maritain, Yves Congar, Henri de Lubac. In America, John Courtney Murray. In Protestantism, it was Bart Bailey, Bonhoeffer, Bultmann, Brunner. I'm not even past the B's yet. In America, the Niebuhrs and later Tillich. Judaism, Buber, Heschel. It was a time in which the elites of the society were aware of some theological stirring, but most of the people involved in that were complaining that it wasn't preachable, wasn't being heard, wasn't grasped by the great majority of the people. And like most revivals of that type, it lacked depth and it began to disappear. And the second stage of the revival in the 1960s was much different. First stage, I like to remember the novelist Nelson Algren's sentence about Dwight Eisenhower and apply it to the revival of his era. As you all remember, Mr. Eisenhower was just a very genial and fine person. When you look back, not a lot seemed to happen under his administration. It all happened after. Vietnam was just not quite seen yet. That came up in the 60s. A lot of the foreign policy decisions of the 50s. But it was an era of good feeling when Eisenhower was around. And Algren once said, Mr. Eisenhower, that man who melted like cotton candy in the mouth of history. And that's pretty much how that revival went. It was sweet. It came and it went, and you don't quite remember, except we have the legacy, and some good legacy of it. Goodwill is always better than bad will. I think it's nice that we have as many, and even as many good, aesthetically good churches from that era. We have most places the facilities we need. There may be a few exceptions at Garden Grove and Orlando and a few places where you need big churches. But most places, things are fairly built up and we can really be free to use our funds for other purposes now. And it was something to fall back on in the 60s when there was a rejection of much institutional religion. There was something at least to reject. Pays to have institutions if you want to be anti-institutional. So we had something at least. But there was no question about it that if you watch the hit of the Shmoo in the 60s, it was much different. And I call that the public phase. And in some respects, it was a hit of the Shmoo religion and not the great masses. The great masses were involved in the other program. To spend $1,000 million a year on church building is indeed voting with your body. That's not coming from headquarters, that's coming from the pews. Whereas the public era, which meant facing up to racial injustice in America, some of the problems of poverty, some of the hopes for the great society. The Vatican Council, the surge of the ecumenical movement, and then in the later part of the decade facing up to the question of the war in Vietnam and war elsewhere, was unquestionably a time of renewal of some dimensions of religion. The people in the pew did have to at least confront the ethical questions that had been postponed in the 50s. There were people who will be remembered a century from now as profound moral leaders in the religious realm. Again, Pope John and Martin Luther King and any number of lesser figures who rubbed the nation's conscience and for a moment got their attention. As soon as we caught on to them, we killed them, but that you always do with prophets. Church participation and church attendance. Here's a place, again, where you're going to have to notice the difference between the head of the Shmoo and the body of the Shmoo. As I turn in my annual reports to Britannica or World Book, I would be writing about clergy in the streets, I would be writing about National Council pronouncements, I would be writing about all those things, but if I compare that to the Sunday bulletins, very little of that would show up. It would show up now and then in crucial places. There's no question about it that everybody was confronted. But if you'd look up Sunday school, 1960s, in the histories of American religion someday, I have a hunch only one thing will ever show, and that is the day a Sunday school was bombed in Birmingham and four little girls were killed. Meanwhile, 30, 40, 50 million American children are in Sunday schools. Something is going on there all the time. And so in a sense, the people both live with and live apart from that public renewal. And like all such revivals, it had to be brief. As I say, as soon as society catches on to it, it's over. It had enough internal flaws. I'm not here to knock the 60s, but you can't look back and see its good without also recognizing its limits. Religion played a big part in the social change of the time. One of my favorite documentations for that is the response to the civil rights legislation of 1965, just before it all ended, between Selma and the burning of Watts and Newark and Detroit, a few month period. Senator Richard Russell, who opposed all the legislation, told us what he thought of the damned clergy and religious leadership who produced all of it, and Senator Hubert Humphrey, who liked it, thanked the clergy for his part. And when the two senators on the far extremes of that legislation both point to one of the same causes, we'd have to say it was one of those rare moments in American history when religious leadership, at least, and some followership, awakened to some ethical questions. But as I say, you certainly aren't going to look back on the 70s as a time when, on the macro scale, our people are involved with those issues. So the third phase of the revival, I call the experiential phase, having an experience. This experience began in the head of the Shmoo. remote from where most of the people live whom we serve, in its most exotic forms, as most renewals do. The first stage of any change is usually the most dramatic. You don't take a society of 218.4 million people and whisper, I move we make a subtle revision and get attention. No, you go to the Pacific, you get baptized in the waters there, you go to Berkeley, you get Newsweek magazine to write about an occult explosion, you get a saffron robe, you shave your hair, you wear pigtails, you use incense, you come out to the airport and meet your guru of the week, you form communes, or whatever it is, and that earliest stage is the most visible assertion that something new is here. And while that may not have directly touched the lives of the people in your congregations, it was DEW, distant early warning that something new is coming. And very soon the rest of the shmoo gets involved. And while a lot of those early exotics are waning or disappearing or changing character or hardening, in biblical faith, Judaism, there's been a revival of Hasidism and Kabbalistic lore and meditative and mystical Jewish writing. And in Christianity, we've had the twin movements of Pentecostal charismatic and evangelical. Code name now in society for the second being largely the born again. Both of which have roots in the Christian past. The born again has much deeper roots in the American longer past and is, I think, probably the one of all the phenomena that's more likely to stay around longest and color our future. It is the modern way of being religious. Interesting paradox in America. We call it the old-time religion, but it's born in the modern world. You didn't need this form of religion any time between earliest Christianity and our own times. If you notice the New Testament born-again language, it is very seldom the language of individual experience. They don't really care about the psychology of the people involved. It's chapters in the history of the Christian church. It is part of that march from Jerusalem to Rome. At each decisive turn, if you'll notice. By the way, born again is always connected with baptism, and that's why I began the way I did here. Always. Pentecost, baptism. Born again, chapter 1. Damascus Road, baptized, scales fell from his eyes. Why do they put that in? Why don't you just give him a certificate and be done with it? It is the new event. Ethiopian eunuch, whole new continent. Well, here's water. What's preventing? Lydia, Europe. Well, here's water. What's preventing? Philippi, jailer, etc., etc. So the chapters of the church are being written in a culture somewhat like our own. Could have given my speech this morning pretty well in 50 A.D. We are a religious people and we are intending to remain a religious people. If you ever read Mars Hill, if you know anything about the cult of the emperor, as Gibbon says, the religion of Jesus' day, in the Greco-Roman Jewish world around them, the religions of the empire were perceived by the people all to be equally true, by the philosophers all to be equally false, and by the magistrates all to be equally useful. So it wasn't all that different from the world I've just described to us. And in the middle of that, you couldn't just inherit the religion of your Jewish foreparents or whatever. You had to, quote, get religion. You had to be born again. You had to undergo this shuv, this turning, in biblical terms. But through Western Christian culture, that wasn't it. When we talk about revivals from 313 A.D. till the 1730s, we're usually talking about people who are already religious getting a little more warmed up, what you inherited having a little more of a treasure. Thus, Lutheran pietism happened among people who are already Lutheran. You weren't something else turning Lutheran. You were Lutheran turning a different kind of Lutheran. And that was true of the Anglican revivals up until Wesley and the Methodists. But then the 1730s and 40s, the modern era is born. People have freedom of choice. Democracy is coming along. There's mobility. There's industrialization. You pick up and go.
And in that world, as I said, religion is no longer just imparted through the genes. It has to be personally acquired. But in the modern world, therefore, you have much more of an individualization of the experience. And that's why I call it an experiential revolution. We're not necessarily writing new chapters in the history of the church. We are writing new autobiographies. We are very interested in the experience of each other. As far as the person who's watching the head of the shmoo is concerned, that's a very interesting phenomenon. That's an interesting other type. Some of you get your kicks through therapy, some of them through primal screen, some through transactional analysis, some through Pentecostalism, some through Hare Krishna. You're typed along the way. In other words, the people we serve are now in a culture in which it is expected that experience be our own. Now, why is that a third stage of revival? Why is that interesting to notice? Because it didn't occur in the earlier two stages. It was not the common language of the two earlier stages of revival. Most of the black leaders were born again, but nobody noticed that about them. When Martin Luther King died, Elizabeth Hardwick in the New York Review of Books wrote an article. She attended the funeral. She said, wasn't it wonderful that they looked up these old Baptist forms of worship just one more time, last time American whites would ever see this? Wasn't it amazing to hear preaching like that and see hear hymns like that? It wasn't dug up from old liturgies. That's what they're doing in Dad King's church every time anybody dies. It was just the, you know, the regular order of service. New York didn't know about it. Whatever else King was, he was a black Baptist preacher. And I once went with him to five black Baptist churches after 10 p.m., 2, 3 in the morning. And if you think he was giving cool lectures on civil rights, you don't know what he was. It was the language of born again. It was very much a part of the movement, but that wasn't perceived. The public didn't know that's what's going on. In the institutional building era, nobody was calling it. I recall an evening in 1969 in Jerusalem where I... name dropping. I just happened to get on an elevator and there was Abraham Joshua Heschel, my favorite rabbi, with one of his notorious $2 cigars. If I quit coffee after being here, I quit cigars after my evening with him. And he said, Marty, it's really interesting, isn't it, that we've gone through 50 years of renewals in American religion, ecumenical, theological, liturgical, biblical, but not there's no experience. We don't have any mystics. We don't have anybody having it. We keep telling people stories about how people once did. It was 1969. I agree. Yep, that's it. And a couple of years later, we noticed we're in this newer stage. And so the people around us have this feeling. It's born of the era of John Wesley and George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards, but it comes to us in a very fresh way, and it is now part of the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist. What do we do about it? You can go shopping down the cafeteria line and pick your experience of the week, and it will tend to go the way it came. I think what we are going to have to do is ask ourselves what are the kinds of experience that are legitimated by our own perception of the gospel, code word tradition or confession, and try to see that grow. If I were an anthropologist giving a lecture on the current interest in the religious experience in the form it's taken, I would say we are rejoining the primitives, and we are in a society that greatly stresses the rites of passage, which is a way of saying that there is a given society, an approved society, and you are, in a sense, children or outsiders unless a certain thing happens. And the anthropologists tell us you pass through a stage where you're suspended from the old security, the liminal stage, and then something happens to you, and then you're brought into the larger society. This is very much a part of what we call having the experience, code name for the Pentecostal experience. It is the born again. But the same thing is happening also in today's Judaism. You're not simply allowed to be nurtured in it. Some experience must happen. But just as with religion, I think there's a double-sided character to this one. On the one hand, again, Christians welcome the fact that the experience of God, which we regard to be intrinsically valuable, don't have to explain it, don't have to justify it, it's just there, taste and see that the Lord is good, that this same experience is connected biblically with a turning of some sort or other from the world. And the most difficult thing today is to have the turning be a turning from the world when the world accepts so much that to which everyone turns. When I'm in the South, and I'm often there, stupid to be a student of American religion and not be there because there's so much religion there, just sort of a gravitational pull. Just I was picturing the world like the Sherwin-Williams paint picture of the globe, and religion is sort of slipping south, and so you gotta go there to find it. And I really have to ask certain questions when I'll hear the minister, as I heard a minister once in a large Baptist church in Dallas, who could report that lights are on in parking lot 8B, stall 34, because there's a light on in his pulpit, who could get the message that a baby is crying in nursery 12F, who could raise the temperature of the room or the sound of his voice with these dials, preaching a sermon against technology. Somewhere. And then I would attend an intergenerational church gathering, and really quite a warm one, and hear young person after young person get up and talk about how they had turned their back on the world, had the born experience again, and come to Jesus. And you ask yourself what world they turned themselves on, because it was really the ticket to the approved adult world. It's what the parents have been waiting for. Now you can join the country club. Now you can go to the University of Texas. Now you can get your Jagger and so on. I don't quite know what the alternative is. I don't know whether in every case, every turn means go and sell all that thou hast and give to the poor. I don't know if it means that everybody has to undertake the most heroic kinds of vision, but I don't think you can go through many generations of using the language of opposition to the world of technology while using technology, or using the language of the evil in the world while producing the world. On April 4th, 1978, one of the safer predictions of the year, there's going to be a new book by Richard Kebido, who wrote The Young Evangelicals and The New Charismatics. It's called The World of Evangelicals. He is one of the young evangelicals himself. He's appreciative of the movement, but he has one sentence that struck me. Today's born-again people are more materialistic than the rest of society. You have the material goods of the rest of society, but you have a legitimation for them. And he goes through the list, the obsession with the sex manuals, the concern that we have more pleasure than anybody else, the concern with all of the bodily contexts, which certainly have a biblical warrant, but then when uprooted from any measure of discipleship, vastly change the character of what it is that we are turning from and turning to. So just as religion is both ways, something that keeps the conversation going but maybe an imprisonment against the gospel, so the religious experience of our time may mean a focus on us instead of on the God who draws us and the Christ who gave himself for us. In a couple of lighthearted columns, I've had my fun with the PTL and the 700 Club. I often listen to them, and I ask you to listen to them once as an outsider, if you're an insider to it, and notice how many of them are excuses to tell one's autobiography, interspersed with certain pious phrases, but a great ego trip, because you can constantly rehearse how great I art. And and I think now, I said before, we had this backward. Our three stages of revival. Normally, revival begins with experience. We're in the third stage. Ours is delayed. Moves into institution and then public expression. And I think that's what we have to watch with our people in the decade ahead. I'm not entirely gloomy about it, by the way. Even if it were, it wouldn't show. I try to give pessimistic speeches to people. Say, why are you so optimistic? I say, cursed with a Charlie Brown appearance. I have a lot of glooms, and I let them hang out once in a while. But I would say that if the record of the Christian church of the past is a sign, it could very well be that the extremely self-centered piety of our day, the hedonistic, narcissistic, I'm saved. I found it kind of personal obsession. Because it at least keeps using the language that God did it and that it was grace, because the Word of God is present in it to keep nurturing the hope that much will come of it, will lead us to later stages. I like to talk about, for example, second phase evangelicalism, and I see many traces of it. Second phase evangelicalism. I attended a meeting, a summit meeting recently of evangelical leaders. There wasn't a person in that room that wasn't asking, how do we move from phase one of the immediate experience to phase two? How do we give expression to it? Richard Kebido's book, The World of Evangelicals, is not a judgmental book, it's a repertorial book, but he's constantly cheered when he finds a group of people who are saying phase two is to move with the bread of life to the bread for the world. It is to move from saying, Lord, Lord, to doing the will of the Father. It is to move from the experience of grace into the expression of grace. And there are signs of that. And I think that for this, the local congregation will be the crucial institution. I'll close with just a couple remarks about that. The reason I think we should be concerned about local congregations here is, back to the original picture, as much as they're tinged by the celebrity world, the television people, the athletes, the beauty queens, the presidents, who are giving new respectability to a language that they were nervous about, in the end, what matters to them, as all the rest fades, is the language of deathbed and divorce court and intergenerational conflict and values as you raise children and values as you are an adolescent acquiring a new world. And that's all done very close to home. And when you have a malignancy, you really don't care that Johnny Cash is a Christian. And when your wife is leaving you, you really don't care that the Pat Boones are getting along well. You need to be put again in range of the deepest biblical, confessional, traditional, and preacherly values. And I think that's the key for what's ahead. And especially in a time like our own, when the ethical decisions are not presented as clearly, at least not to me, I wouldn't know how to make my way through them, as they were in Shall It Be War or Peace? Shall it be racial separation or integration? Shall it be racial injustice or not? To the day when very complex adjustments of economy and ecology and environment and medical care are involved, when there are no big answers because the questions are too blurry. Very often, when we don't know what else to do, we can do something at least locally. We may not tomorrow reform medical care, but we can again care for the ill up close. We may not tomorrow have repersonalized the caring industry, but the Christian congregations of America, whatever else they stand for, at least potentially are caring institutions. We may not overcome all the commercialisms in the world, but we have at least a transaction system here that's not based only on commercial relationships where people can be seen as of value to each other. What I've tried to suggest throughout is something that I once distilled from reading Pascal and then translated into modern language, and that is that the church doesn't just live by the sociological documentation, it lives by the promises of God. And just as it's not wise for us to expect the current stage of the revival to stay around any more than the others, it is our freedom in the gospel to look, to read the signs of the times that are coming and to help orient the church as a light in the midst of the world toward a new day of service marked by this experience of grace which we all share. Thank you.